Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
This is Michael Silverblatt. Because today's show was recorded at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books at UCLA, you may hear background noise during the program. Hello and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Michael Andaja, the author most recently of a book of poems, Handwriting, published by Alfred A. Knopf. He's the author as well of The Cinnamon Peeler, The English Patient, Running in the Family, several other novels, memoirs, books of poetry. Every time I speak to him, and this is, I believe, the third time, I'm able to speak to him a little bit more closely because I understand a little bit more about what it is he has to teach me. And I wanted to say that the book Handwriting seems to me to be mysteriously consistent and to come from several traditions or interests in poetry that are unknown to me. And I wondered if you could begin to describe the backgrounds of the book.
Well, this was a book that I began this writing this poetry after I'd written The English Patient. And I hadn't written poetry for quite some time before that. So, I mean, in the middle of, I think, In the Skin of a Lion, I'd stopped writing poetry because the books, that novel seemed to be so complex and difficult to kind of hold together. And then when I went into The English Patient after that. So it was about 7 or 8 years, you know, of no poetry. So I felt this great loss, felt this real desire to write poetry in the last stages of The English Patient. And I promised myself that I would try to write poetry. I didn't know if I could write it again. It was, you know, that fear that you've left something behind and you don't know if you can recapture it. And I think what happened was I began to write very tentatively and in, I think, quite a different way. I'm not quite sure where it was, but it was a poetry that I then started almost shaving down more and more and more. So I wanted to get to the actual bones of the words as opposed to a more casual line, which I think was there in my earlier poetry. And while I was doing that, I think I was also trying to write something about Sri Lanka and having grown up there and then having gone back there numerous times in the last few years. A country that is, on the one hand, still quite wonderful and subtle and full of a culture, and on the other hand, in the middle of a war. And I think the image of Sri Lanka that's known to the West, certainly, is the image of war only. And having been there, I wanted to try and communicate on one level was that sense of the culture as well, that it wasn't just a country that had to be represented by politicians and violence. Not that one wanted to avoid the war, but, you know, and there were other things happening there.
I'm interested that you talk about that act of essentializing, because my sense of the book is that it moves narrower and narrower and narrower. And so when I came to the last three words, leaping and bowing, I said, oh, yes. Mm. The leaping of the image, the way the images are edited. But for me, the new thing was the sort of sacramental nature of the poetry.
I guess I wasn't very conscious of that shape evolving. I mean, it did in the end.
Yes.
But it was a book where I was writing for quite some time, and the poems seemed to kind of be hovering. I didn't really know how they worked. And I knew that I wouldn't know how that they worked until I found the shape and the form and the order. It was that, and then when I did discover that, then it suddenly kind of, you know, meant double, I think, in a way.
This is Michael Andaja reading a section of the poem Buried from his new book, Handwriting, published by Knopf.
In the heart of the forest, the faith. Stone columns, remnants of a Dagobah in this clearing torn out of jungle. No human image remains. What is eternal is brick, stone, a black lake where water disappears below mud and rises again. The arc of the Dagobah that echoes a mountain. Bow tree, chapter house, image house, a line of stones, the periphery of sleeping quarters for 12th century monks. Their pocket of faith buried away from the world. Dusk. The grass and stone blue, black lake. 700 years ago, a saffron scar of monks moving in the clearing, and at this hour, the sky almost saffron, a saffron bird, in the bowl of rice, a saffron seed. They are here for 200 years. When war reaches them, they carry the statues deeper into jungle and vanish. The pocket is sewn shut. Where water sinks lower than mud, they dig and bury the sacred, then hide beyond this black lake that reappears and disappears. A lake unnamed, save for its color. The lost monks who are overtaken or are silent the rest of their lives, who fade away thin as the skeletons of leaf. 15 generations later, armed men hide in the jungles, trapping animals, plucking the crimson leaf to boil it or burn it or smoke it. Sects of war. 100 beliefs. Men carrying recumbent Buddhas or men carrying mortars, burning the enemy, disappearing into pits when they hear helicopters. Girls with poison necklaces to save themselves from torture. Just as women wear amulets which hold their rolled-up fortunes transcribed on ola leaf. The statue the weight of a cannon barrel, bruising the naked shoulder as they run, hoist to a ledge, then lowered by rope into another dug pit. Burying the Buddha in stone, covered with soft earth, then the corpse of an animal planting a seed there. So roots, like the fingers of a blind monk, spread for 200 years. Over his face.
Michael and Dasha reading Buried from the collection Handwriting, published by Alfred A. Knopf. Now, the image begins with the discovery, yes, or maybe even the burial of the statues of the Buddha, which were buried where?
They were buried, you know, any part of the landscape. I mean, mostly Anuradhapura, which is the a town in the northern section of the country, which was a very ancient and older civilization. And, you know, people saw these statues. I mean, a couple of things happened. One, people would take them for to sell them or to kind of sell them to other people. Some people attacked these statues, always thinking there was treasure inside the figures. And I think in some cases when monks felt their temples were going to be destroyed, you know, they took them and hid them. And, you know, then they died, and then several hundred years later, the statues would be found by archaeologists or probably citizens who then tried to sell it again. You know, so there was this kind of continual burial and unburial all the time. And in a way that parallels in a kind of more innocent way the kind of burials and unburials of the real dead in times of war and, you know, the monsoon of war and stakes.
And it even seems to be about the transition, because what's dug up is sometimes dug up as sacred, but sometimes dug up as artifact or museum piece, in which case it's a discovery and the sacred lies dormant until the next resurgence. And in that way, as you were saying, it is a version of those mists that pass through the English patient's memory, or of those burnt passages waterlogged in the library where things emerge from darkness to efflorescence. It's almost like a theory of culture, a random theory.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, I mean, I do sense that as that whole cultural thing of that loss. I mean, and even the loss of values in the same way. You know, I think there's another poem called What We Lost, which, you know, I sort of just list the various values that are ignored, if not even known in many cases. And, you know, I think these are values that are not lost always to the people in the country, but certainly they're overlooked completely by outsiders.
I'm speaking to Michael Andaja about his book Handwriting, published by Alfred A. Knopf. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm. I noticed that another section of the book is about the reclamation of lost emotions, of lost senses, so that it's not just the ethical values that are lost. You mention in that list the way the women painted their eyes for ceremonies, and then eventually we come to a listing of, is it the 12 emotions?
The nine sentiments.
The nine sentiments. And the nine sentiments are divided as well into rasas, flavors. Mm-hmm. And this is also an act, in a sense, of reclamation, of waking up the senses.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. And here's an example of, I think, where how Western and Eastern love poetry kind of separates. There is a tradition, I think, in the East where, while the poems may seem very informal, they're extremely formal in terms of, if you look at certain kind of Indian love poems, if they take place on the beach or in the forest or on a stony path, all those are signals of what state the love affair is in. And in the same way, the love poems are often a series not to do with the specific lover, though that may generate the poem, but the stages of the love affair, the stages of the romance, whether it's the stage of excitement or boredom or fearfulness or suspicion or jealousy, all those things. So I thought what I would try in these poems is to try that. I mean, use that as a beginning point, but then, in fact, you go your own way, as any poet would, to try and capture moments of those fears or jealousy or desire or sadness or loss. But, I mean, I think one of the things when you were talking earlier on about the trying to recapture those feelings, I mean, the book is in three sections, and the first part is the historical, certainly, and then the second part are these semi-formal love poems. And in the third part, I sort of bring myself into the poems more, remembering an ayah that I had as a child in Sri Lanka when I was a kid, and scenes like that. And so I didn't want to kind of impose myself into the book right at the beginning. I didn't want the poem. I mean, I could have started the book with that first poem in the last section about arriving in a plane and seeing someone who looked like my mother. But I just didn't want it to be that self-centered, so that by the time that you're in the last part, you're just part of one of those fragments of the fabric.
Well, I found that section interesting in particular because suddenly there's almost as if the images are getting rounder. Alternatives are being proposed that are, in a sense, latent. You mentioned early on Thomas Merton's death. He died by electricity, but the line emerged, "But if I had to perish twice." not only a frost line, but the sense that here we are with the infinite roundness of possibility. And that's what I find so moving in your work in general, that its evanescence is of a series of might-have-beens. And that's one of the reasons I always found those people who did work on the historical count in The English Patient to be almost irrelevant when the book clearly was intended as a might-have-been. The way you have done with photographs in the Billy the Kid book as well. A postulation, not an insistence on fact.
No, I agree. I mean, and the whole tradition of history, you know, I mean, in this book, it's just also going back to those fragments, the fragments that in metaphorical terms, are seen written on waves, but, you know, it's often something erased or just there, just so it tells your fortune, but again, the fortune alters, you know, always.
Now, the cover of the book is a photograph, and the acknowledgments in the book suggest that the photograph is of some significance to you, and I wanted to ask you about it.
The cover is a photograph by a man named Lionel Wendt, and he was a photographer in Sri Lanka. in the 50s, well, 50s and 40s, 50s, 60s, and he died, I think, reasonably young. He was part of a culture of photographers and writers. In fact, when people like D.H. Lawrence and others or Neruda came to Sri Lanka, they Wendt was the man who, in fact, kind of brought these writers together and introduced them to local writers. And there's a kind of some kind of irony here, because in Running in the Family, there's a scene where my grandmother asks the very shy Lionel Wendt to carve the meal and turn out to be a live goat in a giant pot. So his first appearance in my works is in Running in the Family, but he was a wonderful photographer. And again, he was a photographer whose work was destroyed by his brother when he died. Most of his work was destroyed, so all of it was burned or cut up. So there was that kind of...
Also, he's another one of those figures whose evidence exists in fragments and
right.
tatters. And very interesting, very interesting. Because I see, as opposed to those fragments, the appearance of things like the... what we assume are letters on the rock faces. One of them appears, you mentioned, on the false title mm-hmm. page of the book, that ultimately there's a crystallization process. On the one hand, there are all of these fragments. On the other hand, it seems like there are certain evidences that do not reveal their content. They are just there as the pure image of the impulse to inscribe, to write, on the rock.
Right. And you have in Sri Lanka what is called a galvihara, which is a term which means essentially living rock. So you have there's a famous statue of a sleeping Buddha in a town called Polonnaruwa. And it's a giant, it's about, you know, almost like 50 feet long or more. And it's a sleeping figure, or 50 yards long, in fact. No, maybe not that long. but you know, there is that sense that this is, they refer to it as a living rock. You know, the rock is alive because the figure is there in the piece. And so that there's always that sense of the sacred cut in stone, or as an example. But then this always also is also mortal. You know, I mean, I had a poem which I didn't put in the end, where, you know, it says in the statues, the arms always drop away first, you know, because the weight of the stone drop away, or the heads get stolen by the enemy. And so there's that tradition of, you know, destruction of it as well.
Now, that relates to the pairing to the bone quality that you wanted in this poem, to cut to the bone. It really is almost a new phase, I think, for you, because I think, for instance, just to take a emblematic title, there's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do. Well, if you care about old songs as much as I do and as much as you do, that's from a Rodgers and Hart lyric, there's a trick with a knife I'm learning to do and everything I've got belongs to you. But it's very slangy, jazzy, offhanded, very little of that kind of tonality in this book. There's very little... sleight of hand or mm-hmm. or cynicism, sort of, you know, what would you say? New purity? Purity is the wrong word.
I don't know. I mean, I think maybe it was because I hadn't written for some time. I mean, written poetry for some time, and maybe I was reacting, coming out of having written a novel, that I wanted to kind of get back to that. You know, I suppose it was, you know, having always loved someone like Loreen Nydecker and seeing, you know, in at 3 or 4 line poem, a wonder, you know. And that kind of, it wasn't precision, it goes almost beyond precision again, going back to if 3 words can be tighter than 4 words, it can also suggest more than 4 words in some way. So I think I was trying to go into that, right? I didn't know how far I could take it that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at the same time, suggest vista, even though it was a very small. I guess the poem Last Ink kind of works in both directions simultaneously there.
Yes, I was thinking the last poem in the book is dedicated to Robin Blazer, who is similarly in a very, I don't know how to even put it, philosophically concrete mysticism,
mm-hmm.
or the realm of the eternal, which is not merely a Platonic realm, but a realm of things we have built to last so they will recur.
It is that recurring thing I guess I'm interested in very much, and almost feels like, you know, it's almost like carrying, the smaller it is, you can carry it further. I think that's the kind of image I had of the poem.
Oh, that's very good. So it's almost, it's not like the Buddha's head, which must be borne, you know, great weight, great procession. By pairing it, by essentializing it, you can carry it in your pocket.
Yeah, I think so.
It's sort of like one of those Bibles that soldiers carried, mm-hmm. That would only become famous when they would catch bullets. tell me, it's irresistible for me to ask, and I'm sure it's resistible for you to answer, but are you working on a novel now?
Yeah, I've been working on a I tentatively call it a novel, and I never know what to call them. I never call it a novel until it's got that final form. But so I've been working on this project for quite a long time, alongside this book, since about 93, and I've been at that quite a while now. So it's still in midair, but I've been at that for quite a while.
Did the extraordinary amount of attention brought to the English Patient alter the attention you bring your own work? I mean this, yeah, in a particular and strange sense, because you've always been interested in a kind of amnesiac relation to fact and image and history, and the attention has always, in the work, been paid to its blur, its loss. Mm. So I wonder, you know, when such writing, and it's quite unusual for such writing, to become widely attended, mm-hmm. it must alter the conditions under which it evolves, I would think.
Well, I hope not. I mean, I think I have enough of a sense of irony about success as I do about failure. You know, I mean, if you get a bad review and a good review, you know, that they, in some ways, that got nothing to do with the book, and in a way, the attention that's given to, the startling attention that was given to that last book, you know, I guess I could have spent my time trying to deal with it. I sort of ignored it, actually, I think. I mean, I was able to kind of, I was working on this other book, which seemed like light years away from the subject and light years away from the filmmaking. And while I participated in the filmmaking, a little bit, you know, just partly because I wanted to learn from people like Walter Murch and Anthony Minghella and others who worked on the film. I mean, I love the people who work with craft in that kind of detail and subtlety, you know. So I learned a lot from that. But, you know, I mean, that was almost like a physical learning, and while I was working on something else, you know. So I hope it hasn't affected it. But I'm sure that some of the things I learned from them in some ways have been helping me with the book, hopefully.
Well, I was particularly interested because over the years that I'd attend public readings of yours, I'd always notice that suddenly sections would be dropped, mm-hmm. even words from sentences, and other words would be added, and that the editing process is sort of continual. The book remains in a kind of evolution. And I suspected that with as complex a film, you had mentioned to me that each character was associated with a different bird call, for instance. I sensed in this book a complexity of editing image with fact, or editing meaning with data, that was quite extraordinary to me. It seemed an entirely different way of working.
Hmm. I'm sure that precision that someone like Murch brings to how the speed of the cut, or the tone of the cut as a result of the speed of the cut, all those things, or what you can add subliminally and what you can suggest with just one small gesture, you know, I think did have an effect on me. And I mean, I love the process of editing a book. You know, it is a more close to sculpture than anything else. You know, you can put the arm back in or take it off or crook the finger this way or, you know, light it a certain way. I think all those things, I mean, I see books having that quality at a final stage where you've thought of everything and you've imagined every possibility of plot, where you then start tuning it in some way that it would work best. And we go back to that thing where it can be, as William says, the machine that has no extra parts in it. Mm-hmm. And also, just again, to suggest more than you think that small thing can suggest.
I wanted to end almost by asking you to free associate about a word. It's a word that I've been finding recurring in John Berger and elsewhere. The word is nomadology. And in a peculiar way, it seemed to be an essential word for Michael Ondaatje. the cultural movement within your work, your own movement in the work to different cultures and histories. Mm-hmm. And I wondered what you think of when you hear that word, nomadology.
Well, I haven't heard that word too often, Michael. But in terms of the nomadic movement of author and play and civilizations, I think it's very central. I'm one of those people, having lived in numerous countries for long periods. You know, I lived in Sri Lanka, then lived in England, then I've lived in Canada, and since then I've gone back to Sri Lanka. So there's a sense of seemingly constant travel. I guess part of that school of writers who is exactly the opposite of someone like Faulkner or Alice Munro, who have that wonderful, firm sense of place, you know, which we all envy, you know, in some way. And at the same time, I know I would be restless there. I think I'm a very claustrophobic person. You know, if I don't know where the exit is in a room, I get difficult, I'll get tense. And I think I always need that, and I think in some way, and it's having that exit, that window in the poem that can suggest something, which is, it could be exactly the opposite of what's going on in the room of the poem.
I've been speaking to Michael Ondaatje. His most recent book is Handwriting, Poems, published by Alfred A. Knopf. You've been listening to Bookworm. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book, off the mouse, pop.